Hi, everybody. My name's Doug Rowell, and I am a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
Grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is just to irritate the newcomers. When I was new, I used to hear people say, I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I'd spend the rest of the meeting trying to figure out what they were talking about, you know. And you hear a thing, they say, grateful alcoholic must be, he means he's an alcoholic, and he's also grateful, but he's not grateful to be an alcoholic, he's grateful, probably grateful he got his job back, maybe. You know, maybe he's grateful he got his family back, or maybe he's grateful he got his driver's license back, but, you know, but he couldn't be grateful to be an alcoholic. That's stupid. And, because who would be, you know? I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. Because for one thing, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't be here tonight. I don't know where I'd be. I don't know what I'd be doing. If I wasn't an alcoholic, for one thing, my life would have probably been a lot more boring than it was. And I wouldn't have got to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm crazy about Alcoholics Anonymous. And also, if I'm not an alcoholic, what the hell's wrong with me? You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's nice to have something to blame it on. It's like... I want to thank John for inviting me to come out here, and thank the committee for not saying no, not that guy. And this is a real fun thing for me to do. This is the most fun thing that I do in my life. I loved speaking at Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I was ever at. You know, but I was. I was a little drunk, though, and so nobody invited me. John was asking me tonight something about a speaker that they had in 87, and he said, you didn't come out here then, did you? And I said, no, I got sober in 87. I was waiting for the call, you know, but... I remember some things about the first AA meeting that I was at, and I know a lot of people, some guys I sponsored and people that I've known, and some people are sober a long time, they can't remember anything about their first meeting except for maybe, you know, that people laughed or something. And I remember that people laughed, although when I came to AA, I thought, well, you know what, I've been laughing for a long time, and it's about time to get serious. And I was ready for it. You know, I thought, okay, I'll just get serious. I'd be serious for the rest of the next half of my life. And if that had been the case, I don't think I could have stayed. But there was laughing at my first meeting, and I do remember that. And I remember a couple of other things. I remember one thing, three separate people. There was maybe 40 people at that meeting, and three separate individuals, two men and a woman, came up to me. You know, you can tell when somebody's walking towards you. You know, it's like, what? They made a point of coming up to me and saying, you're new. It wasn't a question. They said, you're new. And I said, yeah. Yes, I am. And all three of them said, keep coming back. Keep coming back. You know, we throw that around a lot. And it just becomes, you know, it becomes so normal. I mean, it's like a mantra, keep coming back, keep coming back. But people weren't telling me keep coming back when I got here. People who genuinely cared about me, you know, people who loved me were saying, why don't you stay away? Just, you know, don't come over here, okay? So to have three separate strangers come up to me and say, keep coming back, was real special. It was very special. I'll give you an example of what was going on in my life. More than a year before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was invited to a wedding. Some friends, my friends Bob and Carol, were getting married and invited me to the wedding. And I, you know, got the wedding invitation and pulled out all the envelopes. You know, I don't know why they put all those envelopes in there. Got the one that said RSVP, and I sent it back to him. And I RSVP'd, yeah, I'm coming to your wedding. And I went and got him a wedding present. And a couple of days before the wedding, Bob called me and he said, Doug, Carol and I have been talking about it. We'd like for you to not come to the wedding. Now, don't you think most people would say, now, why is that? I didn't do that. I knew why. We had all been at a wedding the weekend before, and I don't know. They had an open bar. I don't know why they do that. Free booze, you know. And I, long story short, I ended up mooning the bride's mother, and you know, it's considered a social faux pas in a lot of circles, and I didn't go there to moon the bride's mother. I just went for the wedding, and I don't know, I was drinking and having fun, and I was having so much fun, I thought, wouldn't it be funny to just drop trow, you know? and I did, and I thought, man, they're going to say, boy, that Doug's crazy, you know? And they did. But it didn't have that same comical connotation that I thought it was going to have. In fact, nobody laughed. Nobody laughed. You know, you kind of want one person to laugh with you, you know. Nobody. And people were coming up to me. People that I know have a good sense of humor. And not showing a bit of it. You know, I go, what's the matter with you, man? God, you mooned the bride's mother. Hey, wasn't that the ceremony? Was that the reception, you know? Sorry, I thought it was the groom's mother, you know. I don't know. But Bob asked me not to come to their wedding. And I just said, okay. You know, I already got him a present. I drank it myself. But that's the way my life was going, you know. So if you're new, you may have some ideas about how to improve Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you do, I understand that. And what I'd suggest you do is find somebody, you know, who's sober quite a while, and pull them aside. Don't do it in front of everybody. Just pull them aside and tell them your ideas about how to improve AA. And I'll bet you a dollar, they say, keep coming back. And it's not a compliment. But do it anyway. Because if you're like me, you don't have any place to go anyway. I didn't have any place to go. I remember I was standing at the back of that meeting. And I don't know if they give cakes here. Some places they don't. In L.A., where I got sober, in the San Fernando Valley, they give birthday cakes, you know, and you can take cakes for a week. Or I've heard people come up, you know, if you have a birthday and like if you're sober 9 years and they give you a cake with 9 candles on it and everybody sings happy birthday and you blow out the candles. My first meeting, I was standing back at the back of the room when they did that. And a woman was taking a cake for 18 years of sobriety, and everybody sang happy birthday to you. It's like standing in the back going, oh, God, I drank myself into Lamesville. Can it get any worse than this? Happy damn birthday. Oh, I'm way too cool for this stuff. And there was a guy standing next to me back there. He nudged me. He said, hey, you stay sober for a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. Really? You mean, let me get this straight. So all I have to do is like not drink a drop of alcohol for 365 days, and you'll give me a cake? I'll tell you what, there's a Vons Market next door. Maybe I'll just go up and pick up my own goddamn cake. You know? I was going to go get a bottle anyway. Yeah, but thanks. Thanks, anyway. And the lady that was taking the cake took this cake for 18 years. She blew out the candles and she said, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I have attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And some people did what you just did. They went, oh. And I went, you kind of dumb, ain't you? You know, because, see, I'm a quick study. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get the gist of this thing, but I know it's not going to take every day for 18 years. You know, but so that's what I remember from my first meeting of AA. It didn't impress me very much, except that people were laughing and having fun, and they had stopped drinking. They weren't drunk. They were laughing like drunk, some of them, just like y'all are. But I knew that they weren't drinking. And the secretary held up this book. And she said, this is the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is our basic text of this program. If you're new here tonight, we suggest that you do not leave here without this book. If you want to steal it, steal it. I heard that. I said, well, that's how I'm getting mine, you know. And I could hardly wait for the coffee break. And it was like, just go. And because I knew even if I got caught, I'd say, secretary said, steal it, you know. It's a, but then she said, then she screwed me all up. She said, the book costs $3.75. And if you don't have the money, we can make very liberal credit arrangements. We can, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get back on your feet. Well, I'm a thief, but I'm proud, you know. It's like, now I'm not going to steal a book because they'll think I'm not on my feet. And so I said, I'll take one of them books. Gave her a $5 bill. I said, keep the change. No problem. $5 for a hardback book, you know. No, maybe you can use it to help some drunk or something, you know. And so I got my book and I took it home and I sat down and then poured a drink and read. Well, I can't say I read. I have this uncanny ability to look at the title of a chapter and know everything that's in the chapter. It's a gift. And I opened the book and I, you know, doctor's opinion. Yeah, like I never had one of those. You ought to not drink so much. Okay, next. Bill's story. Who gives a shit? There's a solution. There's a solution. That's a sales pitch. More about alcoholism. Ooh, I can hardly wait. We agnostics. Chapter 4, We Agnostics. Now, when I went, one thing that disappointed me about Alcoholics Anonymous when I went to my first meeting was all this talk about God. See, my grandmother was a Pentecostal minister. She ran a Skid Row mission in San Pedro, California, down on the wharfs, and she used to help these winos and wharf rats to get sober, feeding them soup and Jesus. So I knew you could get sober that way. I saw it done. You know, it just never seemed worth it to me. But then, and I thought AA was the secular way to get sober without God. But here was all these people up there. I want to thank God and all of you. There's a hospital in San Fernando Valley called the All of You Hospital. And people would say, I want to thank God and all of you. And I think, Jesus, they all got sober to the hospital. And maybe I ought to go up there, you know. I didn't know what they were saying. They said, can we see the hands of any alcoholics? I'd hold up my hands, you know. How can they tell? I was afraid somebody come over and look at you. You ain't an alcoholic. Get out of here, you know. I didn't know. I was trying to listen to the words and I was missing the music entirely but I heard all this God and higher power and all that stuff and I was very disappointed. So when I got to this chapter 4, We Agnostics, I thought, all right, here's how the smart people stay sober without God. So I read that chapter, and I got done with it, and I thought, I must have spaced out. I missed that how the smart people stay sober thing. So I poured another drink, read it again, and I missed it again. And I must have missed the first paragraph where it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop drinking entirely, or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, then you're probably an alcoholic. And if this be the case, you may be suffering from a disease which only a spiritual experience will conquer. That's what it says in the first chapter of We Agnostics. See, they gave it a trick title. but I'm looking for what I want to read in this chapter, and it ain't in there, but I read it and read it and read it. And I read one thing that I remember, I didn't notice it the first time I read it, and I don't think most of us do, but it's a little simple sentence in that chapter that says, we have found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. About the fourth or fifth time I read that, I thought, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Now, that was interesting to me. That was a new take on God, because my grandmother's church, that's not what they said. They said, if you want God to like you, if you want God to listen to your prayers. See, I'm talking about, this is my perception of what I heard in organized religion. I'm not putting down organized religion at all. In fact, I've come to respect all organized religions since I've found God in AA. But at the time, I didn't respect any of them. I was openly hostile to all of them. And my grandmother's church seemed to say to me, if you want God to listen to you, you got to be baptized. Yeah, not just sprinkle like some damn Methodist either. You got to be soaked. You got to be, I believe, you know, and then the other religions. I had friends who were Catholics. It seemed like they had to go to communion and confession before God would even hear them, you know, listen to them. In fact, they couldn't even talk to God. They had to go to his mom, you know, and I thought, what the hell is that all about? And then I had other friends, you know, who they'd be fine if God would listen to them unless they ate some bacon, and then it's all over for you. And then, you know, I had a Muslim friend that had to pray to Mecca 5 times a day, wherever he was, okay, time to pray. What the hell is that? You know, and people over in the Middle East, the Jews and the Muslims are killing each other. And in Ireland, the Catholics and the Protestants are killing each other. And there's Hindus and Buddhists and Jains. Oh, my. And I just, you know, I said, screw them all. You know, I don't want anything to do with those people. They obviously don't know what they're talking about. But here's Alcoholics Anonymous saying, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. And it caught my eye finally. And then I heard people later on in AA saying, you can have a God of your own understanding. And it says that in that chapter. It says, any concept of God seems to be okay with God. And that opened the door a little bit for me. And then I saw a sentence that I just love to this day that was written about me before I was born. And it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis is not an easy decision for us. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis is not an easy decision for us. See, that's us. That's not the worldwide we are the world us. That's us. You know, it's like that little percent of us that's alcoholics, because most people don't have a hard time with that decision. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can test this one. You can check it out. Go stand in front of a Walmart sometime. Stop people when they're coming out. Excuse me, I'm taking a survey. Would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life? Yeah, see what they say. I'm telling you. Most people, no problem, you know. Yeah. When you say alcoholic death, you're talking about the one where you puff up and turn yellow and choke to death on your own blood and vomit? Well, yeah, you know, after you lose everything, you know, it doesn't happen like overnight. Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, you got to find the gutter first, you know, but then, yeah, then puff and yellow and choke, yeah. You know, they'll go get in the long line. That's what most people will do. You know you got an alcoholic if you do that alcoholic death, spiritual life, and you get this. Are you going to be here tomorrow? You know? And yet, I was not going to fit here. I was not going to fit here when I came here. And I'll tell you what, this is the only place in my life I ever fit. I never fit any place. I didn't fit in school. I never fit in the workplace. I didn't fit in my own family. I was so used to not fitting when I got here that it didn't even bother me. And it's not that I that I felt like people didn't like me. I just didn't fit anywhere. When I was in school, I played football, and I liked playing football, but I wasn't a jock, you know, and I knew I wasn't, and the jocks knew I wasn't. And I liked to surf, but I wasn't a surfer, and I knew I wasn't, and the surfers knew I wasn't. You know what I'm saying? I like to ride motorcycles. I love motorcycles, but I wasn't a biker, and I knew I wasn't, and the bikers knew I wasn't. You know, I never fit any place. It's like I won the popular vote, but I lost the electoral. You know what I'm saying? You know? The people like me, all right. I just didn't fit, so I knew I wasn't going to fit here. People were nice and everything, but I knew I wasn't going to fit. I'm used to not fitting, and so I was going to meetings, and the people were nice, you know, and they all said keep coming back, and I didn't have any place better to go anyway, and I was for the first 8 months of my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going to meetings in a lot of different places. I didn't want to, you know, get like what they call. I heard somebody say home group. Ah, I don't want one of those. But in the LA area, there's 2,400 meetings a week, so you can go to different meetings all the time. And I was going to different meetings, and I found some that I like better than others, and I'd start going to them more, you know, and I kind of get known a little bit, you know, because anybody in their first 30 days, Doug, alcoholic, you know, anybody with less than 30 days, Doug, alcoholic, Doug, alcoholic, Doug, alcoholic. And at one point I was at the San Fernando group, which was starting to be kind of a home group for me, because I don't know, when I first walked into that group, it looked like it was all, you know, Mexicans and cowboys and scooter trash and housewives. And I'll tell you, Mexicans and cowboys and scooter trash and housewives have always been very good to me. and so you know, I kind of fell into that San Fernando group. And I was over there one time, and I had been going to AA for a while, about 6 weeks, and raising my hand all the time because I was drinking every day. I tell you, I didn't want to, you know, stop drinking and then find out this thing didn't work, and then where would I be, you know? might forget how to drink or something. So I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have a sobriety date. I wasn't reading the book except for chapter 4. I certainly wasn't taking the steps, and I was drinking every day. But other than that, I had a pretty good program going. And us sitting over at San Fernando, and they said anybody with less than 30 days, and I started to raise my hand automatically, and I thought, you know what? It's none of their business. It's really, thanks, buddy. It's none of their business. It, you know, I'm tired of raising my hand. And so I just didn't, and I sat there. Now, what happened was, at the end of the table, there was two gals sitting down there, and one of them said to the other one, Doug's got 30 days. And I realized what had happened. I had unintentionally misled. And I'm a liar, but, you know, but I try not to mislead people. Now, for instance, my ex-wife said to me one time, did you sleep with my sister? And I said, not a wink. You know, you try to get around lying, actually. But I had sat there through the 30-day thing. This gal thinks that I have 30 days, and she's on my 13-step list, you know. And I was making this list in case I ever stop drinking. These are the girls I'm going to go out with. I didn't want to go out with them while I was still drinking. They might throw a whiskey on me and wrap me out to the group. Then I'm out of AA, and I got no place else to go. But I didn't know her name. She knew. I don't know how she knew my name. Doug Alcoholic, Doug Alcoholic. Doug, but she said, Doug's got 30 days. So I don't know, what do I do? Now, where I come from, they give chips for 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months, 9 months, And so when they said, does anyone want to take a 30-day chip, I felt compelled. My integrity was challenged. So I got up and took the 30-day chip, and they went crazy. They loved it. They're, yeah! Cool. Tell us how you did it. It's nothing. Nothing really, you know. So now I got a sobriety date, 30 days before my first bogus chip. And I started going around taking chips all over the place now, you know, because I got this sobriety date now. And then every once in a while somebody would smell whiskey on me, or they'd see me drinking, or I thought somebody saw me drinking, and then I'd start over, but only at the group where I got smelled, you know. It's like, yeah, I don't want to blow my 90 days at Chandler Lodge, you know. And I got to put a little disclaimer in here. I am not recommending this as a program of recovery. What I did, most people that do it die. But I have to say that I did it because I did do it, and there may be somebody here who was doing that. And if they are, if you're here, keep coming back. Where are you going? Yeah, you got bad timing, brother. He'll be back. He got no place to go. So, by the time I got sober, I had 4 different sobriety dates at 4 different groups, you know, and I was hearing all the words, and I would not hear any of the music, you know. Hey, you got to give it away to keep it. And, yeah, that makes sense. And you have to surrender to win. Never heard that anyplace else. I don't think so. But, you know, whatever. And I heard somebody say, the road gets narrower. And I thought, that doesn't seem like a good thing, is it? You know, it's like the road getting narrower. See, I told you he'd be back. And the road gets narrower. And I went up to a guy and asked him, because he seemed to know some stuff. I said, what is that supposed to mean exactly, the road gets narrower? And he said, well, I'll give you an example. He said, when I was new, I used to smoke, and I would be driving down the street, and I'd just like throw my cigarette butt out the window. And he said, you know, I did that. It was just a normal way of doing things. And one day, I don't know, I was sober for a while, and I thought, geez, I could start a fire. You know, just a careless act of throwing a cigarette out the window, I could start a fire. So what I started to do was put him out and then throw him out the window. And he said, and then it seemed, what am I doing? He said, you know, I'm still littering. Okay, it's just a cigarette butt, but I don't need to do that. I got an ashtray. I can dump it in the trash, you know. So I started to get a little better. And eventually, he said, I quit smoking entirely. And I think that's what it means. And that made perfect sense to me. So now I'm walking around everywhere going, the road gets narrower, you know. There was a guy talking to some of the guys he sponsored. I wasn't one of them. I was just overhearing it, and he said to one of them, I don't know what the topic was exactly, but he said, I'll tell you what, there's some gorgeous women in Alcoholics Anonymous, beautiful women, but I don't play. I'm a happily married man, and I just don't play. And I said, the road gets narrower, and they all looked at me, you know. He said, what? I said, the road gets narrower. He said, you know, I read that book about 100 times, and I never seen that in the book. In fact, in my book, on page 55, it says, come on and join us on the broad highway. You know what? In my book, on page 75, it says, you'll feel like you're walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe on the broad highway. Ain't no road gets narrower anywhere in my book. I thought, I was just trying to help. I was like, all these lyrics are going through my head. By the time, I should tell you that I did get sober. and not from my first meeting. I started looking for ways not to get sober, not to fit. You know, I heard people saying I come from an alcoholic family. Well, I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I didn't, you know, my family was like, I don't know, I had this like great middle-class Orange County family. That's just a family I happened to be born in. My mother went with me to a meeting where I was speaking one night, and she said, you shouldn't tell those people that you don't come from a dysfunctional family. I said, you think a family was dysfunctional? She said, it was okay after you left. You know. Yeah. Perspective. And but my dad drank. He was the kind of guy who would buy a 6-pack of beer and drink one and put 5 in the refrigerator and leave them. I got nothing against refrigerators. I just don't think it should get 5 and I should get 1. And my dad would be doing something on a Saturday afternoon, working on his car, working in the yard, watching a football game. He'd stop and have a beer and then go back to what he was doing. I don't drink like that. I figure if I have a beer, that's what I'm doing. And whatever I was doing before couldn't have been that important, or why would I have stopped? And my mother, I don't know if my mother's an alcoholic. She may be an alcoholic. It's hard to tell because she won't drink. And I asked her one time, how come you don't drink? How come you, after I got sober, now I'm looking for this genetic predisposition, you know, that I hear about. And I want to know why I'm an alcoholic. I said to my mom, how come you don't drink? Are you an alcoholic? She said, I don't know, maybe. She said, you know, when I was young, I used to drink. And every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious. So I just quit. And I said, you got to drink through that, Mom. You know, yeah. See, I'm preaching to the choir now. I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And here in the place I wasn't going to fit. And I got a couple of sisters. One of them lives in Fullerton, and my wife and I went to have dinner with her one night. My wife is also an alcoholic. She was on my 13-step list. I put her right at the top, and she was the first one I went out with after I got sober. Just stayed together. She 13-stepped me when I was 21 days sober, and that's the way it's been. And I'm grateful for it, you know, but sometimes I wish I'd put her at the bottom of the list and work the way down to her, but... or start at the bottom, work the way up the top. But Randy's taught me a lot of stuff. I mean, she was 2.5 years sober when I got here, and she taught me to ask questions. I'm not a question asker. I like to stand next to somebody I think has the answer and wait till they give the answer, you know, and go, that's right. Randy and I were in bed one night, and I had my leg over on her side of the bed, and she threw it, you know, like, get over on your own side. God, you sleep like Jim Parks. And I think, I don't know any Jim Parks. What is she talking about? So I'm laying there working on this resentment, and I know I got to say something, or it's going to come up later. You know, it's going to be, are you going to leave your shoes in the dining room? Shoes my ass. Who's Jim Parks? You know, so I said, honey, am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps? And she starts laughing at me. She goes, Jim across the street. And I said, what? She said, yeah, you know how he puts his truck so you can't park in front of him or behind him? You sleep like Jim Parks. So it's good to ask questions. You can learn some stuff. But anyway, Randy and I went down to my sister's house. Now, my sister is a person who drinks socially. You know, she's not an alcoholic. She drinks socially. And we were at my sister's house. There was 5 of us for dinner. My sister made a pitcher of margaritas in the blender. She set up 3 glasses because she knew we weren't drinking, and she pours them 1, 2, 3, and pours the rest right in the sink. Wasn't going to fit with you guys. That's what we did. We went, eh! my sister said, what? I said, what'd you pour that in the sink for? She said, what do you care? You're not going to drink. I said, and it's not about drinking. It's about respect. She had no clue what I'm talking about. Why don't you put it in the refrigerator, you know? She said, I don't know, maybe I want to use the blender again. Randy says, it's a $40 item. It wouldn't kill you to have 2 of them. See, they don't think about alcohol the way we do. I have another sister in Wichita that I was visiting my sister a few years ago, and I was going to meetings back there, and we were just kind of reconnecting. I was actually there to make amends, you know, and all I had to do to make those amends was went to church with her a couple of times, played with her kids, laughed with her, and hugged her, you know. That was my amends. That's all I needed to do with my sister. We had stopped being friends, and we became friends again. But I was back there visiting, and I said, Yvonne, do you ever drink? Because I'd never seen her take a drink in my life. I said, you go out with your friends and have a cocktail or anything? And she said, yeah, I'll have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's. Whoa, you know, every New Year's, you know, I could say. Yeah, they call that pattern drinking. You better watch it, you know. you know, I'm playing with her. She goes, well, not every New Year's. So, why? Why would you miss your annual glass of wine? She said, I don't know, I always mean to, but sometimes, you know, it's New Year's. The kids are making noise, and there's guns going off outside, and the dogs are barking, and so sometimes I just forget. That's the difference, isn't it? Yeah, because I don't know. If I could have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's, I don't know if I'd do it, but if I did, I certainly wouldn't forget. You know, I would, can you imagine? I'd be shopping wine in October. I'd be watching the Rose Bowl going 364 days, you know. But that's the difference. They don't think about alcohol the way that we do. And so I don't come from an alcoholic family, so I knew I wouldn't fit that way. And I heard people say, I started drinking when I was 9 or 10 years old. And I said, see, that's another way I don't fit. I never had a drink till I was 18. Probably as a result of my grandmother's mission, seeing these guys, these winos and wharf rats, that alcohol had ruined their lives. And they weren't stupid guys, most of them. Some of them were kind of, you know, brain dead, but it was a result of alcohol. But the ones who were lucid, you know, had great jobs, musicians in famous bands and ship's captain and stuff like that. And I saw what alcohol had done to their lives, and I just never was interested. I just really wasn't interested. There wasn't a lot of drinking in my family, and it never interested me. And I had friends in high school that drank, and I didn't. And maybe I never would have drank, except that my friend Morris, who was kind of my sexual sponsor, you know. And Morris said to me, I had this girlfriend, and we'd go park and neck and stuff. And Morris said, you know, if you want to get a home run with this girl, you're going to have to get her drunk. And I heard that. I did. We used to use these baseball terms, you know, first base, second base, you know. I don't even remember where the bases are now. Come on, I'm married. It's like step up to the plate and slide home. But I remember home run, and I did want one. So the next time this girl and I went out and parked, I had a quart of Rainier Ale, which was the national beverage of Garden Grove, where I grew up. See, I still didn't go there to drink. I had a total other agenda. I would have been happy to say, here, drink this. You know, let me know when you're ready. You know, yeah, we're going to party tonight, but it just seemed kind of rude, so I opened it, and I drank some, and I handed it to her, and she drank some. We passed it back and forth till it was gone, and, you know, I'm not, y'all are alcoholics. I'm not going to say a half a quart of Rainier Ale, you know, does the job, but it does if you're 18 years old and you never tasted alcohol before. I got a buzz, and I felt good. I felt loose, and so did she. and it turned out my friend was right. It was the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness, you know, so... So, that night in June of 1963 changed my life. Changed my life. I said, I'm going to do both these things much as I can the rest of my life. So that's how it started. But that's why I said, you know, I was 18 when I had my first drink. I wasn't 9 or 10. They started too young. They started too young. Y'all. like everybody started when they were 9, because that's what I heard and that's what I wanted to hear. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. Y'all came from an alcoholic family, you know. Now, of course, I've heard lots of people who their parents were Mennonites, you know. There was no drinking in their family at all. And people who didn't ever had a drink till they were 40 years old. But I heard what I wanted to hear, the thing that kept me different. It kept me out of being an Alcoholics Anonymous member, and I was an atheist. So those three things separated me from you. And it's a deadly separation. One night, I came home from a meeting with a whiskey. That's the way I came home from a meeting. I laid on the floor and started drinking and watching TV, and I passed out. Woke up about 3 a.m. Now, this happened to me almost every day, so it was no big deal. I woke up at 3 a.m. on the floor, turned off the TV, got my bottle. It was half full, no cap, and started crawling on my hands and knees across the living room, through the hallway, into the bedroom to go to bed. And a lot of people call that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I just called it going to bed. In fact, it seemed kind of smart. You know, hey, you can't fall off the floor. So I got into my bedroom this one night, and I stood up to take my clothes off, and I lost my balance. And I fell on my knees next to the bed and spilled this whiskey all over the bedspread. Picked up the bottle, and there was about this much left. But most of it was soaking into the bedspread. And I set the bottle down, and I grabbed this bedspread, and I just started sucking whiskey out of it, sucking on it as hard as I could. And something like a little voice in my head said, hey, man, that ain't right, you know. brother, look at yourself, you know. Sucking whiskey out of a bedspread. I've been going to AA for 8 months. And I have not learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. And I felt more alone and lost than I've ever felt in my life. Can't explain that. I just felt like there was nowhere to go. And I started to cry. And what I did was I said, God, if you're there, please help me. That's all I said. Got up and went to bed, went to sleep. Over the next couple of weeks, strange things began to happen. I'd go into my favorite liquor store, and instead of one of the three people who should have been behind the counter, there's somebody from AA behind the counter. I knew all the guys behind the counter of that liquor store by name. I knew this guy by name, too. Hey, Ralph, how you doing? What are you doing here? He said, what are you doing here? And so I just, you know, got some cigarettes or something and booked and went and got my bottle somewhere else so I could go to hurry up and not be late for the meeting. And I was in a Mexican restaurant and I started to order a margarita. The waitress is somebody I know from AA. I'm walking through the supermarket, pushing my cart through the liquor department, reach up for a bottle. This gal from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time, keep it simple. Isn't it a beautiful life? And this was happening to me every day. And finally, after it happened for a couple of weeks, I was on my way to work one morning. I just killed my regular morning half pint to get my blood slowed down. And I rolled down the window, and a guy from AA is driving towards me. And he waved, and I threw a bottle out the window. And as I'm driving by, I thought, what the hell is going on? You know, it's like those miracles that they talk about in meetings. And as soon as the word miracle came into my mind, it was like I could hear God laughing. You know what I'm saying? Miracles. And I remembered that I'd been on my knees and said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I suddenly realized that God had heard my prayer and come and help me, and help me in a way that I would notice. I'll tell you something about me. All my life, since my earliest remembrances, the quality of humans that I've admired the most and respected the most is a sense of humor. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. Might be love and compassion would be better, or you know, honesty and integrity, or a good work ethic. But with me, it's always been humor. And God knows that about me. That's the way I'm wired. So he pulled these little pain in the ass God jokes on me, you know. You want some help? How's this? You know, put AA people everywhere I wanted to drink. And all of a sudden, I got this big picture, and I realized I had asked for help. God came to help me. And it was my second step. I didn't realize that at the time. It's the moment that I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. My friend Doris from the Pacoima group, you know her, Bob. Doris says a lot of good things, and one of them is, God is a gentleman, and he doesn't come where he's not invited. And I'll add to that, if you invite him, you better get the guest room ready because he's coming, you know. This was the beginning of my sobriety. And I'm glad that I stuck around long enough and that I lived long enough to get this thing and to start to hear the music. It's the moment that I started to hear the music. And I'll tell you, the lyrics were so confusing to me, all this stuff about surrender to win and give it away to keep it, and the road gets narrower, broad highway, and all that stuff. When I started to hear the music, the lyrics all started to make sense. That's why I like to talk about the music of AA. There's a rhythm and a harmony and a melody that run through this thing that make the words make sense. And when I went to take my first honest 30-day chip, I had enough chips to open a casino, you know, but I went to the Burbank group on a Thursday night, and they give chips and cakes on that night, and I got up and took my 30-day chip, and I said, I'm Doug, I'm an alcoholic. And they said, hi, Doug, and I sat down and I watched other people take chips. And I was just as happy for their chips as I was about my own. And I felt like part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I watched people take cakes, and they had a coffee break, and I felt like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to go get my coffee, and a guy stopped me, and he said, congratulations. I said, thanks. And he said, you know what the secret is? And I said, no. Don't drink, I guess. And he said, just hang on. He said, that's the whole deal here. If you can hang on, you can stay sober. And I thought, I can do that. I grew up around horses. I know something about hanging on. And it sounded like something I could do. And I said, thanks. And I started to get my coffee. And another guy is, there's a guy at the Burbank group named Jim B. He's one of these glad, handing, back-slapping alcoholics. They got him everywhere, you know. He comes up to me and he said, son, congratulations on that white chip. And I said, well, thanks. And he said, you know what the secret is? And I said, yes, sir, hang on. And he said, no, let go. Yeah. Having been privileged to already hear the music and the lyrics make sense, it didn't bother me that the experts didn't know what the hell was a secret. Because I knew they were both right. I'm talking, now we're talking lyrics, you know. And the lyrics can be so confusing until you start to hear the music, and then they make sense. You know, the chapter 5 that Robert read tonight, it talks a lot about honesty. Rigorous honesty. You know, people who don't get sober seem to be constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And even people with grave emotional and mental disorders can get sober if they have the capacity to be honest. So it's pretty clear honesty's got to have something to do with this thing. And I don't know, when I was new, I thought, how honest do you have to be? I mean, I don't know, you know, if I can do it. Like, I'll tell you what, I'm 13 and a half years sober. I lie. Not all the time, and only when I feel divinely directed to do so. My wife says to me, "Honey, you think this dress makes me look fat?" You know, rigorous honesty. "No, baby, I think it's that Haagen-Dazs, you know." "Really? Dress ain't got nothing to do with it. It looked fine on the hanger. But let's go try it on that skinny blonde next door. If it makes her look fat, then it's the dress, you know." See, that's rigorous stupidity. I don't need to do that. The right answer is, I like you in anything or nothing. You know, that's the right answer. And you know, if a waiter says to me, "Sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner?" I lie to the waiter. I always do. I say, "No, thank you." You know, rigorous honesty. Boy, you know what? I'd like a cocktail instead of dinner. I would. I'd like a double Bushmills neat and a margarita back. You know, but I got this disease. It's like a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy and spiritual bankruptcy. You don't want that in your nice restaurant, do you? You know? Send that waiter flying to the kitchen. Yeah, yeah. Don't need to do that. But that's what I'm talking about the lyrics and the music. The lyrics start to make sense when you start to hear the music. You will hear people, I guarantee you, people who were sober a long time misquote the Big Book. Happens every day. I may have done it tonight. And it's never intentional. It's not done to mislead you or anything. It's just we forget, you know, or we don't want to say, "I better look that up," you know. We just say what we think it says. And so I heard a lady when I was new say, "Our book says," well, boy, I'm listening because I'm sober now. You know, I'm listening. If somebody says the book says, well, then I won't have to read it. I can just, you know, get it and go ahead and read it, you know. It never changes. It seems to sometimes, but it doesn't. And she said, "Our book says our drinking was but a symptom of deeper underlying causes and conditions." It does. It says exactly that. Then she went on to add her own stuff. She said, "And if you don't find your deeper underlying cause and condition, you will drink again." That scared the hell out of me. You know, I didn't have a clue of my, I came from this family that was like, they were a classic family. They were like Ozzie and Harriet. My parents lived for their kids. I did not have a bad childhood. It was long, it was like 42 years, you know, but it wasn't bad. And I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition could be. You know, I drank so I could get laid. I got laid. I kept drinking, you know. And then I remembered when I was 24 years old, I went to see a show called Hair. It's a Broadway show about hippies singing and dancing and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I went to see that at the Aquarius Theater, and I fell in love with it. There was a character named Berger that swung on a rope, dropped his pants, you know, and this went out and spirit changed the audience and climbed over the seats. He was this crazy speed freak leader of the tribe. I said, "I could do that." So the next day, I called the Aquarius Theater. I said, "I want to audition for your show." They said, "Fine. Come in Friday at 1 o'clock. So Friday at 1 o'clock, I'm set to go. All day Friday morning, I had my guitar. I was practicing the song I was going to sing. If I sing good enough, maybe I won't have to dance, you know, because this is a Broadway show. I don't know anything about dancing, but I can sing. And I'm practicing the song, and I broke a string on my guitar. And you know, hippies were like, "Bad karma, dude." And I went into my roommate's room to see if he had the string that I needed, and it was laying right in the middle of his dresser in this little envelope. Good karma, dude. So I picked it up, and underneath the envelope, there was a little white capsule. And I thought, You wonder what that is. Oh, is we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything, and you know, somebody dies, you go, hey, don't eat that green shit, and so. It turned out it was THC, a synthetic marijuana, and a nice little psychedelic. See, I hear this wave. Nice psychedelic. And about 45 minutes later, when I got down to the Aquarius Theater, I was floating. Got off. My hair was long, was over my shoulders, and it just swished when I walked. And I had this hip hugger pants, bell bottoms, bells about this big. Foom, foom, foom. Well, you know what? No shirt on, just this vest. Had a vest with six layers of foot-long red, white, and blue leather fringe. I was a walking wind chime, you know. And, they called my name, and I walked up on stage, and I handed the music to the piano player, and he started playing, bomp, 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 bomp. I said, wow, I feel good. See, now, this is rigorous honesty. I felt very good, and... I did that James Brown song, and I felt like I was floating. And I saw the people going, nudging each other. This kid sings. And then I finished, and they said, great. Have you got something a little more low-key, a little more down? And I said, yeah. I did Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay. I did it a cappella, made myself cry. Left my home in Georgia, ow! And they loved it. And I knew they did, I could see they did. And then they said, great, just want to see you dance. I said, hit it. The piano player started to play, and I started to move, and I'm seeing my hair come around. Shh. And the fringe on the vest is going, chow. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? You know, because alcohol and drugs did for me what I could not do for myself. You know? By the way, I hope that no one's offended by my talking about illegal drugs, as some people are, and I never mean to offend anybody. It's just part of my story. I could go get a new story, but I've seen it done, and it's very expensive. If I had known, first time somebody said to me, hey, man, try this, I would have said, oh, no, I'm going to be speaking at an AA meeting in 30 years, and I don't want to piss anybody off. you know what? Bill and Bob didn't talk about illegal drugs when they got sober. I said, Bill and Bob drank illegal drugs. What are you talking about? It was an illegal drug then. anyway, I got the job. They hired me to go play the lead role in the Las Vegas company. And so I went to Las Vegas and played the lead role for 6 months, and then they closed that show, took us on the road. We were the first national tour of Hair, and we traveled around the United States and Canada, all over the place, you know, people would come up to us after the show, come up on stage with tears in their eyes. You were beautiful, man. Here, have some pot, brother. Send some me in. It's Maui Waui. It's Panama Red. Oh, great. Cool. Thanks. And somebody would come up. Yeah, I love you, man. Here, have some acid, brother. It's window pane. It's Osley. It's Purple Haze. Orange Sunshine. You know, oh, wow. You know, some girl would come up to me and say, I love you. Have me. And, okay. And so it was a pretty good job, really. And, still, when I look back at it, after I heard that woman talking about deeper underlying cause and condition, I said, that's what happened. I had this job. I just went, I wanted to sing and dance, and I became this traveling hippie and a minor rock star, and people gave me drugs, and I became a drug addict and an alcoholic. I had the reputation to maintain, and then I was hooked. I was stuck. I called my sponsor. I said, hey, I found it. He said, what'd you find now? I said, my deeper underlying cause and condition. He goes, well, let's hear that. I said, no, really, hair. He said, hair? I tell you, you're not going to drink over your hair. We just cut it off. I said, no, not my hair. Hair. You know, remember I told you about that show I was in, you know, when I was a big star and everything, you know? And he said, oh yeah, hair. He said, I thought you were loaded when you auditioned for that show. See, I told him too much. And I said, yeah. And he said, let me explain something to you. Most people, most non-alcoholic people, really will not take a drug they can't identify before they go to interview for a job they really want. And you know, when he put it that way, it was real clear. I said, okay. He said, so you had a problem when you got that job. I don't know. I said, well, then I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition is. I don't know. You think I'm going to get drunk? He said, no, not if you don't drink. He said, I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition is, but I won't let it bother me. If you want to look for it, fine. It'll give you something to do between meetings. Meanwhile, go to a meeting tomorrow. Call me tomorrow. And read the book tomorrow. And you know what he said? He said, if you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. But read it every day. That's what my first sponsor told me. And God, that was brilliant. Because for me, that was it. I didn't have to get this thing in a hurry. You know, I didn't have to rush through the book and take the steps all in the first 60 days. You know, and I see people do this, and some of them go, okay, I'm better now, see ya. You know, and some people need to do that too, I think. And God knows, you know, God directs us where we need to be. But my sponsor said, if you can't read a page, if you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. But read it every day. And that's what I did. And I've been through that book hundreds of times now. And when I was, it took me 2 years to get to my ninth step. And when I was at the ninth step, I was 2 years sober. I was just 2 years sober. And I said to my father, I owe you some money, and I want to pay you back. And he said, see, I had borrowed money from him here and there, little bits, $500, $1,500, you know, and paid him back some, but not quite. And I still had a running balance. And I said to him, I want to pay you back. And he said, you know what, Doug, I don't care about that money. It doesn't mean anything to me. I don't need it, and I don't want it. You know, look at your life is beautiful. You know, I'm so proud of you, so impressed with what you've done in 2 years. Just forget about the money. And I said, well, that's fine for you. But we have this step that says I have to make amends for harms that I did. And I think borrowing money and not paying it back is a harm. And so you know how much money I owe you? And he said, no, but I got it in the computer. you know, I don't need it, I don't want it. I just, you know, like to look at it once in a while. you know, might hurt my finger punching that delete button. And so my dad sent me an itemized bill. Everything I borrowed and everything I paid back, and the balance was $7,200. I figured it was somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. I missed. I was going to save $3,000 and hand it to him like a big deal. Here's the money I owe you. Yeah, well, you're $4,000 light, you know. I didn't. I started sending my dad a check every Friday. Every Friday, I sent him a check. $20, $30, $50, sometimes a couple of hundred, depends on whatever I could afford, but I never missed a Friday. And I sent him a check and a note, because this is not, you know, Wells Fargo, this is my dad. And I couldn't just send him a check, so I'd write a note. Sometimes it was just a post-it. Sometimes it was a piece of stationery, a piece of notebook paper. Always a note with it. And after about 3 years, he called me. He said, you know how much money you owe me? I said, no, I haven't kept track at all. And he said, $32. So I said, wow. And after 3 years, and we went and had dinner, and I gave him his $32, and he gave me a closeout notice. And he was a funny guy. And you know what I let my dad do that night? Pay for dinner. No, because when every time I would have dinner with my dad, I'd fight him for the check. And my dad would always say, no, I'll get it. That's what a father does. You know, that's a father's job. And I said, come on, Dad, let me buy dinner. Geez, I'm a grown man. You know, let me at least buy dinner. I never knew that what I was really saying was, I owe you all this money. At least let me buy dinner. We don't know the baggage we're carrying till we set it down. When I was free of that baggage, free of that debt, I could let my dad do what he thought a father should do and pay for dinner. It was no big deal. I never paid for another meal when with my dad after a debt was paid. My dad died a few years ago, and I was, and we had been clean for years. And I was going through some of his stuff with my mom, and I found a file that said, Doug. Of course, I pulled it out to see what it was, and I opened it up, and it was all these notes. It was all like 150 notes in there. This big, fat file, and all these little pieces of paper. And I didn't know he saved them. You know, they were trash. And I said to my mother, oh, my God, did you know he saved all these notes? And she said, yeah. Oh, you love those notes. She said, you know, I told him one time, you know, Doug sure loves you. And he said, I know. I got it in his own handwriting. That's a gift that I never would have had if I hadn't insisted on doing the ninth step. And I did the ninth step so I'd stay sober. My dad told me he didn't want the money, you know. I did it to stay sober, and I got this special gift. My dad telling me how much he loved me from the grave. And I believe that every step comes with a personalized gift from God. I've come to see it in my own life and the people that I work with and people that I know in AA. And the book can't tell you what it's going to be. You know, it's a personalized gift, and your sponsor can't tell you. You have to work the step and see what the gift is, you know. I love this program, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only place that I ever fit in my life, you know, and it's just given me a life. I used to hear people say it's given me a life that I beyond my wildest dreams. I'm a wild dreamer, you know, and it's given me a life that I wasn't capable of dreaming of. You know, I'm so happy, so happy. I get to go play with my grandson, the son of a little girl whose stepfather once asked me, don't come over here drunk anymore. I left the house that day and dejected because her stepfather cared more about her than I did. I thought I had a choice. I was so crying so hard that I couldn't drive. And I pulled into a liquor store parking lot and I got a pint of whiskey. And then I could drive. And non-alcoholics, people I really don't fit with, hear me say that and they say, you were so distraught over your drinking that you drank? And I say, yeah, yeah. And they don't understand it. And I come in here and people shake their heads. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. This is the only place I ever fit in my life. This is a place where I learned to hear the music. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, please stick around till you hear the music. I promise you, you will. You have my guarantee. You will hear the music, and the lyrics will start to make sense. In fact, if you shared a laugh with us tonight, that is the music. Thanks for letting me share with you.
Thank you, Doug.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, a catalog of AA and Al-Anon tapes and CDs, or to find out about our Tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at EncoreAA.com.